I'm very happy to introduce our speaker this evening. Her name is Helen. She was born and raised in the Hyde Park area of Chicago. She moved to New York and worked in the GS office there for many years and is now residing in Florida. And Helen's going to fill in the spaces in between. Would you please join me in welcoming her?
Hi, everyone. My name is Helen, and I'm an alcoholic. Can you hear all right? Are we having fun yet? This is a wonderful crowd that's here. You know what we won't do to go to a meeting? I need a meeting desperately, desperately. There's absolutely nothing in my life that is the same as it was last year. My life has been turned totally upside down. And over the last week, I've had more change. And this drunk, I don't know about any of you, but I'm one of those alcoholics who hates change. I just love for things to stay just the same. You know, don't rock the boat. Well, I have uprooted from New York. I've moved down to Florida. I hated Florida. Now I've come to kind of like Florida, but not where I was. So I just closed on something yesterday someplace else. So change, I am absolutely wired and crazy. I was saying to Dorothy, who will be speaking to you tomorrow, who I've known for a number of years, I have no idea of what I'm going to say. No idea. And I think that this is what my sponsor instilled in me right at the beginning of my sobriety, is that when you speak, you don't plan. You ask God to give you an open mind and hopefully that what you say will help someone else who's in that room. And so that's what I will attempt to do tonight, to share a little bit of what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. But first, I would just really like to thank the committee for extending this loving invitation to come and be with you this weekend. Indeed, I was born and raised in Chicago and left here really after I graduated from high school to go on to New York to school, and stayed there pretty much from that time. So it was a long time in New York City, a very long time, with a few visits back to Chicago. And as my alcoholism progressed, the thought of moving back to Chicago to get away from the heat in New York that was being put on me. But not to get ahead of the game, I believe for myself, and I can only speak for myself as an alcoholic, that there is some sort of genetic predisposition for this disease. My family is riddled with it, though they don't admit it. They're still kind of riddled with it. And I'm the only one that fessed up to it, and I think they're still a little embarrassed by the baby sister who admits she's an alcoholic and comes to this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. They kind of put up with it, you know, but they're you can tell that they're a little nervous about who I might say it to when I'm in their company. You know, my sponsor also, who I learned a great deal from in AA, said to me after I had given my first talk that, Helen, when you're able to learn to laugh at yourself is when recovery will have begun. So we're going to have a little laughter here tonight and a little lightness of spirit, because I think that sobriety for me is all about the joy of living and having fun with my life. I lived for too long bound by the shackles of trying to get a quart of scotch when the liquor store was closed. So today, you know, I laughingly refer to myself as Princess Light of Spirit. I don't take things too seriously. You know, I mean, life is too short, and we're going to have fun. I take my sobriety seriously, but I don't take all this other stuff. Because growing up, everybody used to say to me, you look so serious. You know, you look so serious. What's the matter? Nothing was the matter, but I really did look serious all the time. And I was a child who never felt like I fit in. I always wanted to be somebody else. I wanted to be my friend who lived across the street because I thought she had a better life than I did and had more fun than I did and she had more things than I did. And I equated all of that with someone having a very good life. It took sobriety for me to see that I had a lot of things that were given to me as a child, but I had a great deal of trouble accepting that at that time. And so I'm grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous and people like you who have shown me that indeed I am really an okay person, because I didn't know that for a very long time. When I started to drink, I believe that I was just, you know, an alcoholic waiting for that first drink to go down. I loved it. I mean, I loved it. I loved what it did for me. I loved the way it tasted. I loved the way it smelled. And I loved the way it made me feel. It made me feel like I was an adult. People commented on my drinking right from high school. And I wasn't drinking very much at that time. But, you know, we'd get together, and quite often we'd come up here to the north side. I saw the Allerton Hotel there today. And I think about how we used to go to the Tip Top place up there, and I would have whiskey sours. And we'd go to the jazz places on Rush Street. And I never had just one drink. Never. I always wanted more than one. And people would say, well, Helen, don't you ever have one drink? And I thought that was the most ridiculous comment I had ever heard. Made no sense to me. I mean, one drink practically did nothing, so you would need two in order just to feel that princess light of spirit feeling. You know what I mean? One drink just didn't do anything except whet my appetite for more. And that's the story of my drinking, is that once I had that first drink, all I wanted was more. And as I began to drink more, I began to get into more and more trouble. I began having conflict with people. I began to expect from you the things that I demanded in myself. And you know, when you do that and you don't do it in a loving kind of way, people don't take kindly to it. I felt different and apart from all of you, all of my life. And when I drank, I felt a part of and a part of you. And so drinking for me was a necessary means to feel accepted by the human race. You know, I grew up in the era of the silver screen. And it was during the war, and of course, you know, we'd all go to movies as kids, and you'd see a double feature for a quarter. And in the summer, it was great because the movies became air-conditioned and it was a great way to cool off. But I grew up in the movies. And so my thought of what life was all about as an adult was what I saw on the silver screen. And my hero and heroine was Nick and Nora Charles. Love Nick and Nora Charles. They had the most glamorous lifestyle that anyone could possibly have. And they drank from the time they got up in the morning until they passed out in the evening. And I wanted to pattern my life after them. I mean, that to me was reality. That was life. And so when it came time for me to decide what I was going to do with my life, as I became somewhat of an adult, and I put that in quotes. I said to my dad, you know, that I wanted to go away to school. Now, I came from a middle-class family, but not a family that could afford to send me to Smith or Wellesley, you know, but that's where I wanted to go. And when he said he just couldn't financially do that, then I said, well, then I'll think of something else. I had always wanted to be a doctor when I grew up, but I quickly learned that I didn't want to go through the process that you had to go through to be a doctor. I wanted to be one instantly, instantly, like right now, tonight. Put the white coat on me, the stethoscope. Let me run through the halls of the hospital saving lives. That was what I wanted. No, not four years of pre-med and then 4 years of medical school and then all of that other stuff. So I worked one summer at Michael Reese Hospital in Chicago. And I quickly saw that if you became a nurse, then you were put in the atmosphere that I wanted to be in very quickly. And so I decided in very alcoholic fashion, I'll be a nurse. That's all, simple as that. And so I began applying to different nursing schools, one of which was the University of Hawaii. Now, I have to say that sobriety has taught me to love the Turnquest family, but I didn't love them very much back then. I wanted to get as far away from them as I possibly could, and Hawaii seemed like a very good deal. So my dad took a look at the brochures and all that came, and he said, Helen, I can send you there to school, and I will bring you home when you graduate. But there will be no trips home for Christmas or Thanksgiving or vacation or any of that. And so I began to think a little bit better about it, and I decided to go on to New York to school. And that was where I ended up graduating with no great honors, but I thought of myself really as, and people will say today, that I was very good in my profession. My drinking took off there, but it was weekend drinking, and it was party drinking. But it was every time I drank, I got drunk. And I thought that's what you did. When you drink to get drunk. I still don't understand people who hold a glass and watch the ice cubes melt in the drink. I don't understand that. Beats me. So I began drinking a little bit more. And after I graduated from school, I roomed with a couple of classmates, and we began to live that life of the Charleses. You know, we would have our parties. We had our apartment in Manhattan, and I really felt like I was becoming chic and sophisticated and knowledgeable about a lot of things, and certainly knowledgeable about New York and restaurants and bars. Not knowledgeable about life, but knowledgeable about a lot of those places. And, you know, it's very true that as the alcoholism began to take over, though I was not a daily drinker at this time, the attitudes of the alcoholic began to crop into my life even more than they had previously. I began to have trouble with coworkers. I began to have trouble in relationships with everyone. And so I began to think that New York was not the place for me, and that, you know, typical alcoholic fashion, I'll pick up my bag of marbles and go play the game of life somewhere else. So what do you do as a good blossoming alcoholic who was brought up in the movies? I moved to Los Angeles. My sister was living there, and I moved in with her on a temporary basis, with her daughter and her husband, on a temporary basis, until I could find an apartment, and I would get a car, and just maybe even get discovered. I mean, I had great visions of being discovered and being in the movies. It was totally insane at that time and totally unreal. But I believe that if there is this so-called invisible line from social drinking into alcoholism, that I crossed it in California. Now, I also told you that I wanted what I wanted when I wanted it. And I would never take no for an answer. And so when my sister said upon my arrival, let's go look for a car, I said, fine. And she showed me some of these ditzy, ugly things. And I said, no, I want to get that 57 T-Bird convertible that's over there. And I will save up my money to do that. By living with you, I have no rent, and I'll save it up. 2.5 years later, I left my sister's house, not having a driver's license, not having a car, but having a blossoming story of alcoholism. For I had gone from drinking on weekends and party drinking to drinking every day, to coming home from work and having a drink and then a couple of drinks after work, and then drinks with dinner, and then drinks after dinner, and to the point now where many people were commenting on my drinking. And so what I began to do, since I was working and earning my own money, was to buy my own supply and hide it in the closet of my bedroom. And in that way, no one would bother me. I'm not drinking from their bar, I'm drinking my own. But then you drink up your own, you know? And so you hit the bar in the house. And then you have a few more from that, and you see the level going down on those bottles, and you know they're going to hit you with the fact that you've been drinking too much. And so you raise the level of the bottle, you know, by adding a little water to it. And then that's when the lying began, and getting caught with all of the lies, and getting caught by primarily, I'm not drinking that bottle of scotch. But then when you pour it out and it comes out looking like vodka, somebody, you know, has been drinking it. And so my sister and I began having what I call little sibling arguments. And I found that I wasn't very happy in California. I wasn't discovered. And I just didn't like living there. I just didn't like living there. But, you know, you're in a place where you don't like living anywhere. Because I went wherever I went. And I was not very pleased with myself at that time. So what I did was I said, I'll show you. And I'll move back to New York. And, I mean, after all, that's where it's happening. I said there. Concerts and the opera and the theater and the art galleries and people bustling around and this hick town, I never liked it here anyway. It's all these farmers out here. And so I picked up my little bag of marbles and I moved back to New York. And I moved back with something I had not left with, and that was a daily habit of drinking and a daily habit of getting drunk. And all of those things that I went back to New York for, I didn't do. Because I would first have one drink to unwind, and then that one drink would lead to another, and then I would get drunk. And if I got to the theater, I would pass out in the theater. And so I began not doing a lot of the things that I always liked to do. I fell in with a crowd of people who I worked with, who, in my estimation, drank like I did. But they did something else that I didn't do. And that was they would have wonderful dinner parties. And we would all get together and have these great dinners. Really just so that we could sit around and talk and drink is really what it was all about. But we would have the premise of this wonderful dinner party. Now, I didn't know how to cook. I didn't know how to do anything except drink. And my family had always tried to teach me the things that young ladies are supposed to learn so that when you become an adult and you get married and you have children, you know how to maintain a home and all of that. And I wanted no part of it. I said, because when I grow up, I'm going to have people do these things for me. I don't have time to learn all of this stuff. You know, I said, I too many places to go and people to meet and things to do. And so now I found myself in the predicament of wanting to have people over to my house, but not knowing what to do. And so I went out, and, you know, we say in AA, you act as if. You know, well, I acted as if as a drunk. I went out and got cookbooks. And I would study these cookbooks. And I would pick out all of these recipes, the hardest ones. Hardest ones, because then that raises your self-esteem, you see, to some degree. And every recipe I picked out from any cookbook, from the appetizer to the dessert, marinated in something. I I call this my gourmet cooking phase of alcoholism. And while all of these dishes were marinating and bubbling in the kitchen, Helen was marinating right along with it, you know. I was steady sipping on the scotch, and I taste the wine, and I taste the liqueur, and you know, early on in this phase of my gourmet alcoholism, when you arrive for dinner about 7:30, you know, I'd be slightly high, and we'd have drinks, and we'd have hors d'oeuvres, and we'd chit chat a little bit, and I'd get dinner on the table around the chic time of 9:30 or 10. And I'd be able to get it on the table. And I would be able to eat with you. And I'd be able to drink the wine with you. And this was at the beginning of the disco era. And so we would, you know, finish up, and then all of a sudden we'd all want to go dancing. And so we'd go out dancing in New York. And I would be able to get home around 4 o'clock and get up at 7 and go to work the next day. And then, lo and behold, slowly but insidiously and progressively, it got to the point when I would be drunk when you arrived. And I would get dinner, maybe, on the table. But I wouldn't be able to eat because I'd have no appetite. And I would say that I was full from having tasted while I prepared the meal. And midway through, I would just kind of push myself away from the table, and I would just quietly disappear. You wouldn't see or hear from me for the rest of the night. Helen would be out, passed out in the bedroom. And you know, there is a magic hour for an alcoholic, and for me it was around 3:30 in the morning. I would awaken, and I would wonder where you had gone. And I would be angry that you had gone. And the loneliness of the alcoholism began to set in at this time. You know, there's a book out called The Lonely Disease, and it's all about the disease of alcoholism. And I would feel very lonely and feel very sorry for myself. And so what do? I poured a drink, and I would put a record on the stereo. And my favorite song back in those days was Roberta Flack and Donny Hathaway singing Where Is the Love? And I would just play that over and over and over. And I would start out with this drink now singing along, you know. And then I'd kind of dance along a little bit, and then I'd start to cry. And then I'd really feel lonely, so I'd start to make long-distance phone calls. Yeah. I see we have a few others that Ma Bell probably notified as well. And I figured, well, if I'm calling California, it's much earlier there, you know. And so I would make all these calls out to California to so-called friends and family. And then one day the telephone company called me. Well, my sister called me. And she said the telephone company had called her because I refused to pay the bill saying I hadn't made those calls. And she said to me, don't you remember us speaking on the phone whenever? And I didn't know that what I was having were blackouts. And indeed, I was beginning to have blackouts and not knowing what they were. I was beginning to have a lot of things and not know what they were. And so I began looking up my symptoms that I was experiencing in all of these medical textbooks that I had on my shelf. Why I'm still alive is beyond me, because I had some incurable diseases, and Wernicke syndrome was one of them. You know, wet brain was one of them. I was convinced I had cancer of the liver because of the no appetite and the loss of weight and the nausea, and oh, you just name it. But further on in this phase of my drinking, one night the doorbell rang, and bells kind of made me just quiver all over. I couldn't stand it when the phone rang. And when the doorbell rang, mailboxes also put the fear of God into me. I wouldn't go past my mailbox because there were just all these little windowed envelopes from Bloomingdale's and Saks saying I hadn't paid my bill. And I just didn't want to know from any of that. So the doorbell rang, and I had come home from work, and I had done what I did every night. And that was I stopped at the liquor store, and I picked up a quart of scotch to have one drink and watch Walter Cronkite on the news. To relax. Just to relax from the hard day. And I passed out. Because where my tolerance had been very high earlier, my tolerance now was practically nil. And maybe one drink, I would just pass out for a while. And so the doorbell rang, and I had on what had become my favorite at-home drinking costume at that time. It had been once a lovely velour robe that my brother had given me one Christmas, but it had never been cleaned at all. And so it was as stiff as a board. If you took that sucker off, it would stand upright in the corner, you know, with the arms kind of out like this. So I had on this chic, sophisticated outfit, and I silently crept to the door and looked out the peephole, and there were two people who I knew, but I didn't know why they were there. And so I summoned up the courage from somewhere, and I asked them, "What do you want?" And they said, "Helen, you invited us for dinner tonight." Well, the refrigerator had really stopped seeing any fresh food. It had semblances of antibiotics that were germinating in there, you know, and new cures for all kinds of diseases, but none of which I would serve anybody nor eat myself, but I couldn't seem to throw it away, you know. I couldn't seem to throw away empty liquor bottles either. They seemed to accumulate in shoeboxes and under my mattress. And I was living by myself, so who I was hiding this stuff from boggles my mind even today. But at any rate, I gave them some excuse of having some communicable disease and asked them to please go away. And I used diseases at will. It depended upon how much time I needed from work in order to get this act together again to be able to go to work, so that it determined if I had asthma or if I had Susu Gamushi fever. My job was a great enabler. They seemed to believe everything I told them. But then I began being hospitalized for alcohol-related illnesses. I began going from doctor to doctor to try and figure out what was wrong. And whenever anyone asked how much did I drink, I would say one or two. I began having the shakes every day. I began taking that magic little yellow pill, which was 5 milligrams of Valium, which seemed to stop the shakes. And then as the 5 milligrams stopped working, I went to 10 milligrams. So that by the time I got to AA, I was still consuming about a quart of scotch a day along with about 70 to 80 milligrams of Valium. And why I'm still alive is beyond me. And I got all my friends to write prescriptions for me. I mean, it was no problem getting that stuff. I didn't use any other drugs. I was scared to death of other drugs. And I had seen too many other nurses get into drugs and lose their license. And I knew that I did not want to go that route. And I like drinking. I mean, I just like drinking. I tried to get into drugs one time. I asked some friends of mine who kept talking about these mescaline trips, you know, that they would go on and how wonderful they were. So I had gone in on a house at a beach resort in New York with a group of people. And I invited these people out for a weekend, and I said, "Bring some of that stuff with you. I'd like to try it." Well, you know, I got up in the morning. I had Bloody Marys and this and that and the other thing. About 1 o'clock, I was lit. And I said to them, "I'm ready now." And they said, "Helen, it would be totally wasted on you because you drink too much." And so that was my foray into the use of drugs. Things just got worse. My absenteeism got worse. I was hospitalized about 3 times. And I had an accident at work. And I was sent home on a 2-week disability because I had pulled a hamstring muscle, as only an alcoholic can, and that was on a dry tile floor. I slept on a dry tile floor. And I was sent home to rest and recuperate. And I rested and recuperated by drinking round the clock and watching the soap operas and wondering why my life couldn't be like Erica's on all my children. You know, I mean, you see that program today and you say, and they, people have problem with the insanity part of this disease. When I went back is really for the first time I felt frightened. I went back to work and I was walking down the hall and I felt like I was walking on a tight wire. And that at any second I was going to tumble over into insanity. And that got my attention. Because psych affiliation showed me that when you were insane, you were locked up. And I was frightened to death of that. And so for the first time, I shared with another person, and it was a doctor, how much I had been drinking and my use of Valium. And he put me in the hospital, and my internist came to see me, and I said, Al, I want to see a psychiatrist, because I'm losing my mind. And this was in August, and in New York, most shrinks go away the month of August. They're all out in East Hampton, communing with each other, or something. And Al said to me, Helen, there are very few who are on staff who are here right now, but there is one guy. And I don't know much about him, but if he's on the staff here, he must be good. And so this doctor came to see me, and indeed he was good. This guy clearly saw that I was suffering from the disease of alcoholism. And he knew that where I should go for help was to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, there were a few little side steps that had to be made before he did that, such as send me home on medical leave, where I was to not drink, and to take all of these other little bags of pills that he had given me. But nobody told me how not to drink. No one told me how not to drink. And I got out to California to my sisters. A family rallied around to help the baby sister again. And I had all of these pills, but I didn't know how not to drink, and so I drank on the plane. I mean, that's what you do, going to California on vacation. I mean, I felt like I was on vacation, and I was drunk when I arrived, and I stayed drunk the whole time I was there and using these pills and having major blackouts. But when I got back, I began to see him twice a week, and whenever I would miss an appointment, he would call me at home, and invariably, I would be drunk, and I would be slurring my words. And it was in November of 73, he hit me with the question of if I thought I was an alcoholic. And I said, oh my God, no. I said, I'm a heavy drinker. I said, but I come from a family of heavy drinkers. And I said, this is my cross to bear. You know, I said, I can't possibly be an alcoholic because I drink good booze. You know, it's amazing to me as I think back on how I behaved and what I said. But, you know, he just looked at me and he kind of nodded his head and he said, Helen, I really think you're wasting your money with me, that I think the only people who can help you are the sober recovering alcoholics in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went, oh my God. I didn't grow up to go to something called Alcoholics Anonymous. Immediately, I thought about a room with a bare light bulb and these little old men in army overcoats in the middle of the summer, you know, bemoaning the fact, with tambourines and playing in the background, bemoaning the fact that they could no longer drink. And my family had not brought me up for this to happen to me, you know, kind of thing. So I thanked him very much, and I told him I'd think about it. You know, that was November, and I mean, that's before the holiday season. You can't go to some place called AA in the holiday season. That's holiday season connotates guilt-free drinking. Guilt-free drinking. Everybody does it, and everybody gets drunk. So I told him I'd think about it. I will spare you that last Christmas I had drinking. But let me say that my next door neighbor made the mistake of asking me to water her plants while she went home for the holiday season. I went and I watered her plants, and I stayed in her apartment the whole time she was gone, hiding out and drinking her booze and making long distance phone calls. I loved the telephone when I was drinking. Loved the telephone when I was drinking. Now, not only did I not show up for work, but something new happened. I didn't call to say I wouldn't be there. And that was a first. And when they told me that, I argued with them that that was a lie. And January was a very tenuous time on my job. I thought I was going to be fired at any second. And it was in February of 1974 that I eventually called AA. The seed had been planted by this psychiatrist. And February the 15th of 74, it finally bore fruit. It was not the first call I made that day. I poured a drink, I got up, and I said, I can't go to work today. And I poured a drink to think about what I was going to do with the rest of my life. The first drink always gave me insight into a problem. You know, how that insight comes. So I thought, oh my God, I can join the Hope Ship or go into the Peace Corps. But then I remembered the Peace Corps didn't pay very well and the Hope Ship had disbanded, you know. And then I poured the second drink, and with that second drink, wisdom came. And I knew that I had to leave New York that day, quit my job and leave New York that day, just close the door to all the problems that were in that apartment and split. And so the light bulb went off, and I thought, my God, I can join the armed services. I would automatically be an officer. They had these officers' clubs, you know, and happy hour, and the drinks are only 50 cents. And maybe I would meet a nice doctor and get married, and he could take care of me for the rest of my life. And with that, I got out the Yellow Pages, and I looked up the U.S. military services that were located in Times Square. You've seen it all in the movies, right? That little thing right there in Times Square. And I called, and I had to close one eye to make the line straight, you know? And nobody answered the telephone. I called the Army, the Navy, the whoever. I called them all, and nobody answered the phone. It's as though they knew this active drunk was calling, and they went out for an extended coffee break. But the most wonderful thing happened is that I had nowhere else to go. And I had nowhere else to call. And I just laid back on my bed and I started to sob. And I said, my God, not even the armed services wants me. And I don't know how long it took, but AA came to mind. And I found the number and I called and a man answered. And I thought, it's all men, just like I thought. So I said to him, I said, I'd like to speak to a woman, please. And he said, I'll have someone call you right back. And a woman called, and we got together, and we talked that day. And she tried to get me to go. I have no idea of what she said. No idea. And I didn't like her very much either. And she tried to get me to go to a meeting that night, and I wanted no part of it that night. I figure if I'm going to stop drinking forever, I want to tie one last good one on. And that's what I attempted to do. And 2 days later, I came to in my apartment, and I had a name and a phone number on my night table. And I called it, and it was a woman who lived in my neighborhood, and she made a 12-step call by herself. And she came to see me, and she asked me how much I drank and if I used any pills. And I told her, and she said, "Helen, I think you need to go into the hospital." And I thought she meant to the hospital where I was employed. And I said, "Oh, my God, I can't go there in this condition." I was totally humiliated and embarrassed. And she did just what I needed. She said just what I needed to hear. And that was, "Oh, no, my dear. We have special places for people like you." She began to nip away at the arrogance and the ego of this alcoholic. And she made the arrangements, and I went to a drying out place on Long Island for 7 days. And that's where I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. Not through classes, but through people like yourselves coming in to have a cup of coffee and gathering a few of us and having what they called these little mini meetings where they shared what they were like, what happened, and what they're like now. And I found my head nodding in identification. And I found myself beginning to relax a little bit that there were other people like me, that I was not unique, and that I was not different, and that I was not a bad person. And so I began to then go into the library of this old drying out place, and there was AA literature there. And I saw the 12 steps of AA. And when I saw the first step, I started to cry. Because I had tried to find those very simple words to define what was happening to me on a daily basis. For years, I had tried to find those words. Every morning when I got up, I said, "I am not going to drink when I get home tonight." And I would leave work, I would get in a cab, and I would go home and stop at the liquor store and say, "I'll have one," and watch Walter Cronkite. Just one. It explained to me why I couldn't get my checkbook balanced, why I couldn't get bills paid, why I couldn't get laundry done, why I couldn't even take a shower on a regular basis anymore. My life had become total chaos, total chaos. And yet this step told me that there were others like me. And so when I got out, I began going to AA. But I was full of false pride, and I was arrogant and grandiose, and I was really obnoxious is what I was. And I would sit in the back of the room, and I would listen, and I loved the stories, and I identified with everyone that I heard, but I couldn't do the one simple thing that you told me to do, and that was to reach out and ask for help. I acted as if I knew everything, and I was scared to death, and I was frightened of you. I had a great deal of trouble going to women's meetings when I was newly sober, for fear that I would be judged and I would not measure up in some kind of way. I had absolutely no self-esteem, none whatsoever, and I was scared to death. And with those things still very present in me, I stayed sober or dry for about 6 weeks, and then I picked up a drink, and I drank for 3 more weeks, and I got back here truly through the grace of God. Truly through the grace of God. And when I went to a meeting that night, and there's a woman sitting in the front row who was a member of that group, the Perry Street group in Greenwich Village in New York, and we had a member of that group who called it Shanghai Lil's. It's in a tiny little room. It looks like an old bar down on the waterfront is what it looks like, and they have the bare bulbs hanging down there. And when meeting time came, they'd yank the chain and the room would go dark, you know, so nobody could see you. It was wonderful. Wonderful place for a newcomer, you know. But you really learn about life. I did. and sobriety in that room. And there was a woman who came into the meeting that night who I had heard speak on a few occasions because she was celebrating her 14th anniversary at that time. And she had that look in her eye of peace and serenity and joy. And I had not seen eyes like that, and I wanted what this woman had. And so I asked her if she would be my sponsor. And she said, "Helen, I would be delighted." And so that, from that night on, and that was April 22nd, 1974, from that night on, I have been on a journey that is not to be believed. I would sit at my dining room table with a quart of scotch, and as I was getting drunk and fretting about my life, I would say, if only my family had taught me, "Helen, number one, you do this. Number two, you do that. Number three, you do the other. Then maybe I would be okay." Well, I found 1 through 12, which is a plan for living in the 12 steps of AA. And that has been my plan for life, these 22 years of sobriety. And it's not to say that every day has been a day in which I can laugh off things. I had multiple problems when I came to you. I was physically very sick from my alcoholism. I was financially in a great deal of debt when I came to you. I had a job that I didn't know if I wanted to do it when I grew up, you know, kind of thing. And so I had all kinds of problems. But I did what you told me to do, and that was to go to meetings. And at that time, we said to the newcomer, "Sit and listen. Take the cotton out of your ears and put it in your mouth." And I would sit there and I would listen. And I would say to my sponsor, "All right, you tell me that this is a disease." And, you know, being a nurse and you want to know what the cure is. And so I said, "Then how do you get well from this?" And she said, "Helen, it's all in the 12 steps. And here's the 12 and 12, and you'll begin going to step meetings now." She said, "You'll pick out a group that will be your home group." And in New York, most of our groups have more than one meeting a week. And one of those is generally a step meeting. And so I picked out a group where I really liked the people. And I began that journey of sitting and listening to them and how they applied the steps in their daily lives. And, you know, I didn't understand a lot, and I would read the step as I was taught before going to the meeting, and it didn't make a lot of sense. But slowly but surely, you begin to, or I did, I began to clear up. I began to get active in a group. I became very interested in this fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I would ask my sponsor loads of questions about AA. And one day she handed me a book that totally changed my life. It was not the big book. I had the big book of AA. But it was a book called Alcoholics Anonymous Comes of Age. That book, where I drank to feel a part of, that book told me about this miracle program that we have. And I wanted to be a part of it. And to be a part of it, I had to be active. And I was still arrogant enough to think I knew how to run everything the best way. And so I say that my service journey in Alcoholics Anonymous taught me how to talk with people and not at people. It taught me how to communicate with you and not to be disagreeable because I didn't like what you had to say. And so I began the journey. I began having doubts of the profession I had chosen, if this is what I wanted to do. And so I would talk with my sponsor. You know, I had grandiose ideas still that I would be a counselor in an employee assistance program, saving all those drunk nurses and doctors at the hospital, because Lord knows there were a slew of them there. And I was going to be the one to save their souls.
And so I began finding people who worked in the field of alcoholism. And then slowly but surely, I began to work in the field for a while. But my sponsor, because I was having tremendous problems with mental problems with my job. I just didn't like it anymore. I didn't want the tension and the stress of the area that I worked in. And I had been to all of the areas that I wanted to work in. The cardiac surgery I had done, labor and delivery I had done, and the operating room where I found myself at that point. I just didn't want to do it anymore. And so I talked with her, and she asked me a question that I will share with you, because it's a question that hit me right between the eyes. And it's something that taught me and instilled in me the spirituality of this program. And it helped me to develop a faith in a power greater than myself. And the question was, if I was willing to believe that God had a path for me, and when I was ready, it would be made known. I looked her right in the eye and I said, I don't know if I can swallow that. But I knew she believed it. And I believed in her. I believed in her. And so I did what we say to do. And I acted as if, and I said, yes, I do. And the most wonderful thing happened. Weight of the world lifted from my shoulders. Weight of the world lifted from my shoulders. And it taught me how to live a day at a time. It taught me to take that job for just one day. That I wasn't doing that for the rest of my life, just for that one day. And you can get through anything for just a day. But then I began to apply it in all areas of my life. That when I am ready, the path that I am to take will be made known. It's the most freeing thing in the world. And so if anyone is having problems, I ask you that question tonight. And know that I believe it. And if you can't believe it, act as if. Act as if. And so what happened as a result of that is that I just did what I was doing each day, and being in a place at a time that was just right, I was offered a job at the General Service Office of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I took that job, and I worked for you all for 18 years. 18 years. Hardest job I ever had. Alcoholics are the hardest people in the world to please. You know, they want what they want when they want it, which is right now. And no cajoling them about, you don't really need this, you know, in a loving kind of way. I had to use my psychiatric nurse's voice many days working at GSO. But GSO offered me the opportunity to travel a great deal for AA. And we have as the theme of this conference the language of the heart. And I've had the opportunity to go to meetings in Italy, Germany, Mexico, Central America, and I've been to non-English speaking meetings in those countries, and the most wonderful thing happens. You know when they're talking about their drinking story, you know they're all kind of jazzed up, and the hands are going, and you don't know what they're saying, but you know what they're saying. And then you know when they get to AA. Most wonderful enlightenment in the world. Their whole demeanor and face changes. And a serenity kind of exudes from them. And so, though we may not speak the same language, we indeed do speak the language of the heart in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's a miracle to see it happen, and I've seen it happen numerous times. Last year, I was on a trip to Texas, and I was in a place called College Station, Texas.
Oh, all right.
And I was in my hotel room and awakened about 2 o'clock in the morning with a tremendous pain in my chest. And I thought it was from the spicy Mexican food that I had had late for dinner that night. And so I paced the room. And I thought a couple of times maybe I should call the doctor. And to make a long story short, I had a heart attack and didn't know it. And got back to New York through the grace of God again. And I told my doctor about it and went in for a cardiogram, and indeed it showed that I had had a heart attack. And so I ended up in the hospital last January, it was. And after I got out, I got a message from a friend of mine who happens to be on the board, who shared that the board had approved an early retirement package for GSO, for those who had been there and were of a certain age. And I kind of fit that category, you know, and I said, oh, whoopee. And so I decided to avail myself of that. And so I left GSO the end of June last year. So last year was my conference. Last year's conference was my last. And I'll miss it, and I wish you Godspeed when you go. And I decided to move to Florida with an AA friend. Never been there before. Never been there before. But I have enough AA friends down there who said, you'll love it. And I got down there and I hated it. Oh, my God, I hated it. It was hotter than blazes. I couldn't find my way around. And I thought, what am I doing here? And I miss New York. And did I make the right decision, the wrong decision? I said, well, you can always go back. But give it a chance. Give it 90 days. You know, give it 90 days. All right? Well, I just closed on a place yesterday, so that it looks like I'm going to stay in Florida at least for a little time, and I've grown to like it. It's different, but I've grown to like it. And I think, if nothing else, AA has given me the faith to try other things. And though I hate change, wonderful things can come about as a result of change. Just like wonderful things came about when I learned that I didn't have to drink today. And so I'd like to close, because I know it's about that time. They said, speak for as long as you want. But you know, the thing is, you don't tell an alcoholic that, because they'll just go on forever, forever. Something outside of ourselves take over. And, you know, you just go and you go and you go. But suffice it to say that I have had a journey the likes of which I never could have planned for myself. And where, when I drank, I had these great visions of setting the world on fire and then having that balloon burst when the shrink said to me, AA is the place for you to go. I have found that where I drank to feel a part of, and as my alcoholism progressed, I felt more and more apart from, that being sober in AA, I truly feel that I am a part of for the first time in my life. I heard something at one of the very first conferences that I went to, and it was part of a keynote speech that one of our trustees gave, and I'd just like to share it with you because it epitomizes to me what we're really all about in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's a parable, and I hope that I can, I know that I won't say it verbatim, but you'll get the gist of it, I hope. But the holy man asked the Lord one day if he could see what heaven and hell were like. And the Lord led him to two doors. And when they opened the first door and looked in the center of this room there was a large round table. And in the center of this table was a large pot of stew, which smelled so delicious it made the holy man's mouth water. Sitting around the table, there were people who were thin and sickly. in the midst of all that plenty. But they were holding long-handled spoons that were so fashioned they could not get them back to their mouths. And the holy man said, I don't understand. And the Lord said, you have seen hell. And he led him to the second door. And when they opened it, there was the same round table and the same pot of stew and the same long-handled spoons. But here the people were laughing and talking and were well nourished. And the holy man said, but I don't understand. And the Lord said, it is really very simple. You see, they have learned to feed each other. And indeed, isn't that what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous? And so I thank you for allowing me to partake of this banquet this weekend, of the sharing of your experience, strength, and hope. I'm happy to be here. Thank you.